You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Thank you and good afternoon. We're at the Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club. This is a great American story. This is a great Arizona story. It's a great Tucson story. It is a great story about life and people helping people. The idea that 12,000 immigrants have come through here looking for a better life from a life of terror and horror and helped by neighbors such as the folks that are volunteering here is a story that will warm your heart. And walking through this fabulous building, this Benedictine monastery, is just a rewarding experience just to see it and feel it. And it truly is one of the great and most remarkable structures of all of Tucson. And I think it's one of our greatest treasures. And thanks to the new ownership of this magnificent building, it will always be preserved, at least the major portion of it, as a public housing event or a public structure that will always be preserved. Leading off our show is Dr. Richard Carmona, the former Surgeon General of the United States. Richard, welcome to the show.
John, happy to be with you.
All right, this is a story of triumph over evil, isn't it?
It's heartbreaking, you know, to come here and see these people struggling, see the children that show their fear on their faces, and then others that have been here a little longer are playing. But just the journey to get here, really to find a better life. And I think we're fortunate for two things. I think we're fortunate we have such a warm-hearted, welcoming community and the people of the Benedictine Monastery who volunteer their time. And I think I want to blow some smoke in your way because without you highlighting this and showing the people the great humanity that this community can experience in helping these folks, they wouldn't know about it. And it's something we should all be proud of because it's not a political issue. This is a humanitarian issue.
You're a man of the world. You travel the world as the Surgeon General of the United States. You know about El Salvador. You know about
yes.
Guatemala, Honduras. There's no reason for anyone to believe that this is fake news when you talk about the cartels, the terrible, terrible circumstances of the gangs of all three of these countries and a lack of a government to control it. This is real fear, and this is real terror for the people that have fled. Nobody's making this up.
No, I would agree with you, John, and I think we must also remember that the United States always held itself out as a beacon of hope for those populations who were oppressed, who were being, you know, downtrodden, beaten. And so, I mean, it's the values that we all hold dearly, the Statue of Liberty, you know, that come to our shores, okay? And what makes our country so strong is its diversity. And yet we still have people fighting that. And yet on a daily basis, diversity continues paradoxically to divide us. And it's terrible. So I think we're doing the right thing here. I think the community is helping these folks so that they can transition to their sponsors around the country and start a new life, become taxpayers, raise their kids, to go to college, to become business owners, doctors, and so on. This is still the land of opportunity.
It strikes me, too, as a situation in which we do give foreign aid, or we had been giving foreign aid to these three countries, to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. To cut that aid off seems to be cutting your nose off to spite your face. I can't think of a better term to explain it. Why would this country do something like that? Isn't the foreign aid a means by which to improve the quality of life for those that are receiving it?
Well, that's certainly the idea. And the idea, of course, being that if we can create a semblance of normality in their countries, then they don't need to flee. And it's not only money, but it's giving the humanitarian assistance. It's giving the professional assistance on how to build a democracy, how to govern, how to take care of your people, how to build a health system. Our U.S. Public Health Service, our Peace Corps, USAID, that's what they specialize in all over the world. So it's not just the money. It's really building infrastructure that we can be proud of, that we're helping others to have a stable economy and a stable life. Because it doesn't exist in those countries, people do flee. And we lack the appropriate infrastructure to be able to quickly adjudicate and make a decision because we don't have comprehensive immigration reform, which we should have had a long time ago.
Why didn't we do that? I mean, why didn't that happen?
Well, my guess is, to be honest with you, it's political. Because when you separate the politics and look at the issue, we can do like a lot of other countries to say, all right, how many people should we be letting in what ways? How do we secure the border? How do we do it humanely? Yes, there'll still be people trying to come in. And when they do, how do we treat them humanely? How do we partner with their countries to get them back there quickly in a humane fashion, not separating children from their moms and dads, things like that? But we have this patchwork here that just doesn't work. When I was Surgeon General, the president then was George Bush. And he worked with Teddy Kennedy to come up with a pathway to citizenship, and because they both realized there was no sense in making this a political issue. They said, why don't we just settle this, okay? Let's figure out a way that we can get rid of the people that are bad people that snuck in. Let's identify those who have become productive citizens and figure out how we can let them transition. Let's close the border, seal it, make sure it's a safe, secure border, and then under the appropriate policy, allow people to immigrate in that benefits them and benefits us. That was really it. And because of the politics, it never got through. And you had one of the most liberal leaders in Teddy Kennedy and a very conservative leader in George Bush coming together telling you the same thing.
Amazing. And it should happen again.
It should. I agree with you.
The idea, too, I think, is in a situation where you look at the eyes of these young children and their mothers and their fathers, all of the people that are here are really here for a short period of time, and they moved to a place of sponsorship. They're all on a board here, and they're getting on buses. They're here, like I say, for not a long period of time. But in the eyes of these people, you can see pain. I mean, if you walk 1,000 miles across Mexico, walk it. I don't talk about taking a bus or a train or plane. I'm talking about walking across Mexico and then go through this process that we have put people through at the border, and they have survived all of that and then are a step or two away from a better life. That's pretty amazing. That's a courageous person who wants to make a difference in the lives of not only themselves but their family.
But John, it's courageous. I would say to you, if you or I lived in an area where our family was threatened in a whole host of ways, and there was a deprivation of food, of water, of safety, drug cartels, all those bad things, would we not do the same thing to save our family?
We'd have the courage to do that.
Right. We'd go across any border, and we would plead with that person, please allow me to come because my family's dying, we're being oppressed, and so on. And we just need to have an appropriate system to be able to adjudicate that.
Yeah, I was talking with you in the last conversation about the photograph of the young father and the daughter wrapped in one shirt and, of course, drowned in the Rio Grande and face down in the mud.
Heartbreaking.
That photograph will be with me all my life. I tell you, it haunts me. It really does. I mean, I have daughters of my own. I love my children so much. And to think of myself taking that kind of risk to save the lives of not only my child but myself and the rest of my family, and then failing to do so.
Yes.
It's just a terrible horror story. It really is.
Well, I think John, you know, what I see here gives me hope, because I see our humanity and our community being expressed, that people who Border Patrol dropped off, they have a place to go, they have sponsors, but we're providing that interim step to get them ready, have them fed, clothes for the trip, and we send them on their way. What troubles me more is the Inspector General's report that came out about the atrocities on the border and how children and families are being separated, humiliated, you know, and herded into these rooms. And, you know, this is our U.S. Inspector General that's calling out the government and saying, guys, this is inhumane besides possibly illegal. You know, and I'm just thinking, I understand there's a lot of people, and there is a humanitarian crisis, but it is up to us to handle this humanely. These are human beings, whether they're right or wrong. And if they need to go back to their countries, that's fine. Let's have a process we can adjudicate that. But in the interim, we are the United States of America, and our values are greater than that.
We hope that they are.
Yes.
You know, and this is not going to go away. There's always going to be people pressing our borders for a better life. That's never changed.
Yes.
Sometimes it's thousands, sometimes it's hundreds, but it's always there.
Yes.
And as long as we are what we are, they will be what they are, seeking a better life. And we have to find a mechanism to accommodate that.
Yes.
As we have accommodated immigrants all of our lives. I'm a grandson of an immigrant. You are as well,
we
for God's
all.
Sake. You know, come from someplace else.
Unless you're an American Indian, we're all immigrants and our ancestors.
Sure.
But the challenge has been, quite frankly, that those people ostensibly that are elected to represent us have failed us. How many years have we had this discussion about some form of comprehensive immigration reform? The job of these elected officials is not to power play this based on which party is in power, But democracy is predicated on compromise. Okay? What can we do that benefits our nation, but benefits those people? How do we partner with those appropriate governments to say, this is how we're going to do things, and you need to help us? It's, if you get the politics out of it, it's not that difficult. The challenge is that often this becomes a currency for parties to beat each other up and blame the other side. And it's what I call the plague of politics, okay? We need to get above that. Because we need to solve this problem. It's costly, not only in dollars, but in the lack of humanity that is being expressed with fellow human beings.
You know, on the other side of this, this is an amazing partnership between three entities of social services like the Catholic services here that have helped orchestrate a means by which we can handle these large numbers of people coming and going through right. Tucson. And the government, which is Ward 6 councilperson Steve Kosach, ex-city of Tucson. Now the county's getting involved. The state of Arizona may be involved as well. And then, of course, you've got literally the private sector, because this is a private building
it is.
Owned by a private entity who had to say, yes, you could come to my building and stay here. You take the private sector, the social service sector, and the government sector working together in a partnership. This is a beautiful story.
But let me say, I know it is a beautiful story, and I love it because, as I said, it shows the humanity in
yes.
all of us. But I want to give a shout out to one person, and that's Steve Kosachik, who I've known for 30-something years. He has never shied away from a difficult problem before he was elected official. And even now as an elected official, he doesn't have to be here. He's here making sure things go right. He's here encouraging you and me to tell the story so the public is aware of it. And I just want to give him a shout out because often, people take for granted. This is a guy who is a reasonable person who works very hard. And I think often doesn't get the credit he deserves when he stands up for very complicated issues that sometimes politicians want to shy away from because it's not politically correct. And I give him credit for standing up and saying, no, this is about the United States. It's about values. It's about humanity. And I think that's wonderful.
I've told him on the air. I've told him privately. This is his legacy. This is an
yes.
amazing legacy. Another thing that I've also told him is, here's an individual who started out as a Republican, then became a Democrat, and then became an individual who said, look, I'm not spending one dime, John, on your show or any place else to run for re-election. People know who I am. They know what I've done. They either like it or they don't. They're either going to vote for me or die. Who says that? Most incumbents will hang on with a death grip that no one has ever seen before just to stay in office. And he went, look, I'm not spending any money. You know who I am? Vote yes or vote no. And I mean, how many people would do that? Not very many.
I don't think
that separates him from a lot of people and a lot of politicians I've known over many years.
I think you're right that most people wouldn't have the guts to do that. But I think what he's saying is, I am not spinning any stories. I rest on my accomplishments.
Yeah.
So look at my record. Look at the issues I've taken on to be able to support you. And if you like what I've done, then vote for me.
Yes,
so
exactly.
I think that, but in a lot of ways it may sound Pollyannish, but shouldn't that way our government be?
Yeah, it should
rather
be that
than
way.
Buying elections and
sure.
special interest groups and
sure.
money coming in and, you know, gerrymandering, the special funds that kind of nobody can identify where they come from. There's a whole host of things. Term limits is another one. You know, as a nation, we need to look at that. And, you know, the whole electoral system that's come up recently. I mean, I'm very concerned about the present challenges to our democracy, including the Russians, you know, trying to undermine our democracy. So we need honest people who are selfless, who are willing to serve, subordinate their own interests for the public good. And that was the idea of the founding fathers. Back then, they were farmers.
Yeah.
But we expect you're going to leave your farm for a year or two and come here and work and then go home, represent your community. But now it's kind of evolved into a business.
You know, when you ran for the United States Senate a few years back, it was a $5, $6 million deal. Now it's like a $50 million. Can you imagine the amount of money in this race for the U.S. Senate in 2020 in the state of Arizona? It has quadrupled. It has gone far beyond anything anyone could imagine.
Well,
we're talking about tens of millions of dollars.
Well, in some states, it's much, much. Look at Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts. I mean, it was incredible what she was raising. But then for the presidency, you're talking maybe $2 billion each candidate
Good Lord.
That make it there. And yeah. So what do they spend that money on? ads to be able to beat up the other guy. What could I do with $2 million to immunize children, make people healthy, you know, support the programs that Steve Kozacik is trying to push, you know, for humanitarian assistance and all of that? I mean, there's so much we can do. So, we, you know, I always think of Winston Churchill, who said, you know, democracy is terrible except for everything else.
For everything
you know,
else.
But I think I can't be complacent because I know we can be better. And that's what we should always strive to be better.
You're one of my heroes. Thanks for being on the show with me.
Thank you, John. Thank you for all you're doing.
Well, we've been around a long time.
We have.
And it's great to see you again. Thanks for being on the show.
Likewise.
Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club, the location of the John C. Scott broadcast for this Wednesday. Well, we'll talk with Teresa Cavendish. She is with the Catholic Community Services that are a part of putting this whole idea together, that there is a place to come if you're battling a means by which to stay in this country because you have faced terror and horror and death in your country of your origin. And it's an American story, a great Arizona story, and a story of Tucson as well. Teresa Cavendish of Catholic Community Services, my guest next on the John C. Scott Political Forum. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum, now in our 31st year of continuous political talk. Live from the Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club, this is the John C. Scott Show. With us, Teresa Cavendish of Catholic Community Services. Teresa, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could join me. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And how did this happen, that community services of the Catholic Church would take over this responsibility of moving over 12,000 people through this facility to a better place? How did that happen?
So the Casa Elitas program, which is actually the name of this whole effort, started in the summer of 2014.
Really?
So it's 5 years ago. And
we never heard about it then, did we?
You know, it was a much smaller effort. And it was actually started by the community at large, where people were responding to migrants who had been left at the Greyhound bus station by ICE.
Yeah.
And so that was probably, you know, 35 to 50 folks a day. And the bus station employees were pretty concerned because folks were being dropped off in a van in a parking lot and just pointed in towards the building and said, go in there and hopefully they can help you. And so
there's a language problem.
There's language, there's
money.
There's not knowing where you are, not knowing where you are going relative to, you know, where you came from. So it was really overwhelming for folks. Plus, they might not have eaten or had anything to drink in a while. There are babies who are in, you know, 3-day-old diapers. But, you know, you haven't had a shower in a few weeks, and you just came out of a detention center. So, you know, it's, you're not having your finest moment.
No.
And then you're asked to make one of the more critical decisions of your life is, how do I get myself out of this with no resources and no knowledge of what to do next? So the community was responding. Groups like Casa Mariposa and just other intentional hospitality groups in the community were coming in and saying, you know, let's bring some water, let's bring some Gatorade, let's bring some Spanish speakers, and folks who are willing to lend a hand to these folks to help them understand what to do next. And that that effort was continuing for, you know, a few weeks at a time, and folks were even taking some of the migrants home with them because we don't have a 24/7 bus station, and people arrive and can't get their bus ticket from their families who have to buy it, you know, from out of state, out of the city. And they can't get that bus ticket. And so people were being stranded at the bus station, and it closed at, you know, 1:32 in the morning, and they had to leave. And so where did you go? Well, it's the streets of Tucson, and that's not the most welcoming place, as some of us know. So the families were being taken home with some of the volunteers. Eventually, this became overwhelming. I would think pretty shortly it became overwhelming.
Absolutely.
And so groups were reaching out to nonprofits within the community and faith-based organizations and saying, what can you do to help? They originally came to Catholic Community Services and said, would you serve as a donation repository for us? If we put something out in the community and we're saying we're looking for basically granola bars and Gatorade, would you let us store some here? And my boss said absolutely and asked me where we were going to put everything. And I was thinking, you know, a couple cases of Gatorade in the corner of a of an office? What's the big deal? Within 4 or 5 days, people couldn't see over their desks. They were surrounded by so many donations. So that very quickly moved to us going to the bus station to see what this was all about. And then seeing there was a whole lot of volunteers and a lot of activity, and maybe we can help in other ways. Maybe we can help get organized. Maybe we can bring in some of our other nonprofit partners in the community. And maybe we can offer some stability. And so it grew from there.
Well, these are people of the same category that are here now, and that is, absolutely, these are not illegal people.
No.
They've gone through a legal process.
They are all being
and
released by
they're not illegal
the
aliens. They're not illegal migrants.
Yes.
These are people going through a legal system,
yes,
in a legal way.
They have entered the
country. So people should understand that. Yes. You know, we're not harboring illegals here.
No, we are not picking people up from the desert.
Right.
These are folks who have presented themselves.
And God bless
to
people who do
officials.
That.
Nobody should have to suffer like that.
No.
So, but these are folks who have presented themselves to immigration officials, asked
right.
for assistance, asked to enter our country and enter into the legal process, have begun that process, and have been released by our government into the community to continue that process. The very next step these folks need to take is to go to join their sponsors and families here in the United States. That's where we come in.
Now, they have a place to go. They have a destination.
They do.
And you're facilitating them getting there.
Yes.
As best you can.
Right.
They're not here very long, 2-3 days perhaps at
yes.
the most. And
mm-hmm.
then they're put on buses or whatever
right.
transportation
mm-hmm.
that is available and taken to places where there is someone who can help them.
Right.
And has been a part of this whole process, more than likely.
Right. So their sponsor or their families are
right.
in their destination cities, which
right.
Through Casalitas we have sent folks to 49 other states.
Wow.
So it's there are no exceptions at this point. And their families and sponsors are waiting and to receive them, have paid for their transportation to leave Tucson and to move forward to whatever corner of the country they're going into. And the families have agreed to take care of the folks who are coming to them and make sure that they begin the process and attend their hearings.
Well, by the way, this facility has turned out to be just an absolute blessing.
Absolutely.
You can't say it any other way.
Mm-hmm.
The Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club. You'll be going to the Tucson Detention Center. I want to talk about that in a moment. But how did this come about? I mean, we know about the private sector, the individual who bought it saying,
yes.
Okay, Mr. Kasachek, mm-hmm. Councilman, I'll open the doors
sure.
for you.
Yeah.
And just come on in, and we'll take care of as many as we can for as long as we can. And that's
uh-huh.
coming to a close, isn't it?
It no, is.
At the end of this month,
yes.
right? And you've had over 12,000. That's a lot of
isn't
people.
Isn't that amazing?
It is astounding.
Yeah.
That's an astounding uh-huh. figure.
Yeah.
And how many volunteers? Hundreds.
We have hundreds of volunteers. So we have well over 400 volunteers and over 100 volunteers who are in the building every day. And that doesn't include our medical volunteers. We have another 180 medical volunteers.
Yeah, I was talking to Dr. Carmona and I was saying, people don't understand their history. You walk 1,000 miles across Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a hard time walking down the street.
Sure.
You know, sure. 1,000 miles.
And you're bringing your child with you.
Yeah, I mean, oh, my Lord.
You're malnourished and dehydrated. And
the challenge is just to stay alive through that whole
mm-hmm.
process, then get across the border, which has been an enormous challenge for so many,
mm-hmm.
and then you're still on your way.
Right.
You're still in transit.
Right.
It's not over yet.
It's still not over. There's still a great deal of
And you're just helping facilitate this moving on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing. Catholic Community Services and this whole process at this monastery, how did that all come about?
So when Ross Rolney, the
yeah,
building
the owner, he's a private owner who bought the place.
And he's a rather amazing person.
Yeah, we'll be talking to him. Just to meet him.
When Ross took the chance on offering us this space. It was over Christmas. We were operating out of a hotel on the south side of town, which we've been to a few times because we had so many people who were coming to join us. So many of our guests were coming in that it exceeded the two regular homes that we operate here. We're operating out of here in Tucson. And so we had a couple hundred other folks who needed some space. We were housing them in a hotel, providing all of our services in that location. And there was a little media coverage about that. And Ross thought, you know, I can do better. Maybe they would benefit. This has to be expensive, so maybe they would benefit from using this space. So he gave us the tour, and he almost apologetically said, you know, I know it's big, I know it's empty, it's not full of much. Do you still think you could work here? And I was so excited. I know I screamed the word yes at him. and said, yes, thank you so much. And it grew from there. We thought we would have a little bit of time to ease into it. From the point that we had the keys until ICE came to us and said, we have an excessive number of folks that we could not house any other area. We had 6 hours to get into this building. And so we were moving really fast, and there was only a chair in the building.
Wow.
So we have more than a chair in right now. But Catholic Community Services has operated the Casalitas program now for 5 years. In that time, we have received over 18,000 people, but as you said, 12,000 of those folks have joined us here in the monastery.
Wow.
And we're not in a position that we can stand down, that we can reduce the capacity to serve this population in our community. There simply is not enough space, so there needs to be another large central location that Casalitas is able to operate from. So that's where our next endeavor comes in.
All right, let's talk about the next endeavor, the Tucson Detention Center to house these migrants. How did that come about?
So we have, there was a time over the Palm Sunday weekend, I remember that time period, where we had over 700 people already in shelter here in Tucson, and there was another 150 folks coming in, and there was nowhere for them to go. And so we reached out to the city and to the county and asked them for help, because it was a public safety issue. It was going to be a public health issue. There were going to be 150 people on the streets of Tucson directly outside the bus station by that evening if there weren't some options. So the county and the city stepped up, addressed it like the public health and safety issue it was, were able to bring some folks in there. So they experienced firsthand what it is that we do every day, and many of the other shelters here in town, and realized the same we're finally confronted with the fact that this is not going to go away. So they maintained a partnership with us to look for larger space, to emulate the services that are happening here at the monastery, because they were aware of the closure timeline. Very much that, as we certainly shared with anybody that we saw, that we can't be here forever. We need assistance in looking for other things. We looked at dozens of different locations, and the one that kept rising as the best possibility was the space that the county owned.
And that was the detention center.
Yes.
Which is vacant.
That portion of the building is very vacant. Much vacant, and has been vacant
for
a very long time.
Right,
yes.
And these were cells, I guess, cell blocks or whatever.
Pods,
I don't know what they were. They had security doors.
Yeah, they call them pods.
But you can keep the door open now, and you're not going to.
There will be no locked doors.
no locked doors, but it's a facility that can work. Because there's so many restrooms and so many people that can be accommodated in a comfortable place where the temperature is not 115 degrees and you're not walking around the street, and you can be served food, and it is a safe, comfortable place, I would think.
Yes, it definitely.
Compared to what the options are.
Well, the options are being on the streets.
115 degrees.
Being on the streets. And even though there are other shelters here in Tucson, they aren't able to operate at the capacity to work with a large group of families.
Now,
you're going to
take these volunteers that have helped you here at the Benedictine Monastery and move them. Right over
yes,
to the detention.
Yes, absolutely.
Center.
And there's a lot of enthusiasm for these volunteers to come. They see the vision. They see, as we all do, that we absolutely have the capacity to build respectful, attractive, warm, honorable services out of any location we go to. What really transforms and elevates the space is the nature of the work. It's the people doing the work. It's the volunteers. It's the goodness, use simple terms, the goodness around the work that we're doing. And that can be done anywhere. And beyond that, but it's this isn't going to be just an anywhere. We're going to make it amazing because we have that ability. We already have the vision in our mind of what this looks like. We have community partners who are not just stepping up but running towards us and saying, please, will you allow us to assist in making this attractive and making this welcoming and warm, to show how our community really wants to respect the work and respect the people who are coming.
Well, Teresa, it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
I've told Dr. Kavanaugh, I've told Dr. Carmona, and I'm talking with you, Teresa, that this is an American story, a great American story of the cooperation between government,
absolutely,
between the private sector, social service sector, all working together to better the lives and to save the lives of people who are in jeopardy. It's an amazing story. It really, and a community who accepts it.
Yes.
And takes a great deal of pride,
yes,
in it. And even though they're just bystanders, basically.
But we still welcome people, and we don't want anyone to suffer in this community. We're willing to work for that.
Well, thank you so much for being on our radio show.
Thank you so
much.
And
thank you for what you do. Teresa Cavendish has been with us, Catholic Community Services. Chuck Hulkerberry, the Chief Administrator of Pima County, will be my guest after these messages. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum. We're live today from the Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club. 12,000 migrants have come through this facility on their way to locations throughout the United States after going through the process at the border of seeking amnesty and are at least looking for a better opportunity to live in this country and alien status. With us now is Chuck Hulkerberry, the Chief Administrator of Pima County. The Juvenile Detention Center will be the new home for these people coming through here. And thank goodness the folks here at Catholic Services have found something like that. It was their idea. They had looked at places, right?
Yes, it was. And it was a letter from the bishop that actually suggested that it be made available. They've looked at Catholic Community Services, looked probably a dozen or more different locations, trying to find something suitable to replace the monastery. And I think they've come to the conclusion after visiting the vacant juvenile facility that it was the best option available. And the bishop wrote a letter to members of the board and myself and asked for our consideration. And I think we then consulted with Catholic Community Services because we've been interested in what they're doing and been supporting of it. And so we think it will work. And it will work with very little modification, if any, to the facility. And we also believe that it probably will actually flow better, provide more process, provide more security, provide more, we'll say, privacy for the individuals who are involved in these processes. And so I think it will work out very well.
Is the county benefit in any way? Is there money exchanged at all?
No. The only thing that
you can donate this. It's legal to do this.
Well, we're basically asking that our costs be reimbursed, which they're eligible to be reimbursed through something called the Humanitarian Aid Grant. And that's been set forth in what they call Operation Stone Garden funding, which is border security funding. Rules have been written for it, and we will be applying to offset all of the operating costs associated with that facility probably on Thursday.
Well, this is pretty timely because the Stone Garden money was fought over one time or another, and a lot of people didn't know how to get it toward a humanitarian effort. This is the way to do that.
Yeah, this is was made available in 2016.
Wow.
We were the first and probably the only county so far in the country to apply for it. So we're applying on Thursday to the Arizona Department.
You ought to be at the top of the list.
We would hope
the
so.
The only one on the list.
We would hope so because yeah. It's very important that in this transition, these people are basically here just a few days, and so they need shelter, and they need food and water, and they need travel arrangements that can be made so their safety to their sponsor is pretty much guaranteed.
You know, again, I was talking about putting together the private sector. Of course, the owner of this particular building here, that the owner of the Benedictine Monastery, who just said, take it and use it as you will, and I'll help you get through this, and it'll be a marvelous opportunity to house these people for the brief time that they need to be here. So it was a private sector gift almost. And then it turned around with Ward 6 councilperson Steve Kosacek trying to coordinate things. The county got involved now with the Juvenile Detention Center. So you got the public sector, the private sector, social service sector with Catholic Services all coming together to do a marvelous thing, a wonderful thing.
It's one of the best partnerships you can have.
It is, absolutely. And you can do wonderful things if you come together like that.
That's correct. That's correct.
And, you know, that's what makes Tucson a special place. And I've seen that for 50-some years.
Yep.
Before you were born.
Yep, probably.
I've been here that long. But the simple truth is, that's the kind of town we are.
Yeah, and I think,
mean, for all the times we beat it up, it's a wonderful place.
Yeah, and I think when, you know, you've got the city and the county working together, you've got the private sector volunteering, and you've got the faith-based nonprofit community basically operating these things, you can't get a better combination.
You know, the county has always taken a stand about water in the desert for those that are trying to. Where is that situation at the moment?
We're still providing funding for Humane Borders, which is really putting water stations in the desert. And, we, you know,
saving
initially,
lives.
It saves lives, and it doesn't necessarily just save migrants' lives. It saves anyone who's out there who could very well be a Pima County resident or a citizen of this country. And so it's really something that I think has benefited far beyond just the migrant community.
You've taken a look at the border over many years as the chief administrator of Pima County, which is obviously a border county. What's happening to the border is frightening, isn't it? I mean, it is to me.
I can remember 20 years ago where you would walk across the border and, you know, you'd go during the day and come back at night, and there wasn't really much, you know, we'll say, interest, or no one really cared. It was more of a, you know, kind of a local community event. It wasn't this national border security emergency that we appear to be in trouble in right now.
And, yeah,
that's correct. Yeah.
It's changed so dramatically. This government's failed to have a policy that makes sense. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, it doesn't make any sense in the way they're doing this.
You know, it doesn't. What you need to do is have a policy enacted, and Congress needs to basically, and, you know, everyone needs to try and figure out how to compromise and get some rational policy along the border, because what happens in this particular case, the border communities, you know, we have a four-county border coalition. And it's really to talk about issues on the border. And the border is more than just immigration. It's trade. It's economic development. It's things that basically benefit both sides of the border. And so we just need to come to some really rational discussion about what our federal border policy ought to be, and then set it in place and stick with it.
Immigration reform shouldn't be impossible, should it?
No, I don't think so. It's something that we've been talking about forever and really haven't made much progress in the last decade.
You know, and it was so frightening as we were threatening Mexico, our trading partner, our largest trading partner, through this whole process with tariffs and other threats. I thought we're just going to blow this whole thing up. I mean, and you've seen the growth of this dollar amount that's just astounding. I mean, it's unbelievable, the billions of dollars that are involved.
Everybody needs to understand that economic development occurs across the border.
Right.
And if, in fact, you know, basically hurt one side versus the other, it hurts everybody.
Well, it's amazing how we've been able to hopefully stand off from the tariff situation that would be so dramatic and so damaging to both sides of the border. As you take a look at the whole situation with the border, is there any solution that Pima County can be involved in? What else can you do?
Well, we're really at the mercy of the federal government. And you know, the best example is the fact that in providing the facilities at the juvenile complex, they were built with taxpayer money, but they're idle. They're vacant. And so what we're asking the federal government to do is pay the operating costs associated with operating that facility, because this is not something that we asked for to do, but it's something that we need to do in order to make this community safe.
You know, forgive me for moving to another subject, but you're in front of me. I want to get to it, and that is, are you ever finding the money to build the roads that are necessary, improve the roads that are there? How is that ever going to be manageable?
Well, we're getting there. We're getting there.
How are you getting there?
We're getting there. This basic budget discussion and debate that we had with the board was, I think, very productive, because we decided to move from what we call capital debt financing to pay-as-you-go financing. And this board, by adopting the budget that they did and setting the tax rates where they are, have initiated that process. So we're going to be growing $5 million a year every year for the next 5 years to be deposited into an account that fixes only roads, along with the transportation money that we're going to get. So this year, we're putting about $26 million into road repair. That's more money than we put in road repair in probably the last 5 years. And the next year is going to be another $5 million on top of that. The following year, another now it'll be $10 million on top of that. And so it grows.
Estimated cost, though, to fix these roads is 10 times that.
Oh, it is. And so, you know, what we're doing as much as we can locally, but we also need to address the fact that both the state government and the federal government need to figure out how to finance transportation. We've avoided the hard choices about financing transportation in this state now for 30 years. We haven't raised a gas tax since 1970. So if you look at that, it's 30 or 40 years ago was the last time we basically raised the gas tax. So we got to come to some basic conclusions.
Why would not this legislature do that? I mean, it is a source of user payment. People drive, they pay for the privilege of driving.
I think what you see is the no tax pledges. And the no tax pledges came about in the last decade or two where, you know, everyone pledged to not raise taxes. And so, therefore, that pretty much said they were anti-tax and that might help them in an election. But when you get elected, you got two responsibilities. You basically have to govern and you have to solve problems. And in the case of transportation, the only way to solve the problem is increase the transportation revenues, which means taxes.
Well, and the whole idea, too, is you've got to be able to have that revenue source because that's the only thing that's going to pay for this, right?
Yeah.
And there's no other place to get it.
And we have every other state around us raising taxes,
sure,
raising gas taxes.
Yeah.
California just raised another 6 cents a few days ago on July the 1st.
Right. And we can't seem to be able to do that.
And we need to figure out how to do that. We need to figure out how to get the courage to say we have to increase transportation taxes in order to have the revenues to have good roads. What everybody doesn't understand is good roads basically mean economic development and economic prosperity. I've never seen any place prosper economically that's had a poor transportation system.
We still don't get the amount of HERF funds that we need at all, do we?
No, we don't. And you know, that's just an accident of legislation and the way the distribution was structured. Pima County, our unincorporated area, gets about $120 per capita in what we call HERF revenues. With our friends up in Maricopa County having an unincorporated population less than ours, they get about $350. So they get
three times
the revenue for less people.
And that's why the roads are better.
And that's why everyone says, well, Maricopa's roads are great. Well, there's a reason Maricopa's roads are great. They get three to four times the revenues that we do.
Well, you've gone out to the voters for bond money to fix roads and for maintenance and such and have been turned down every time. Is that a lack of confidence in the administration of Pima County, or is that just a lack of willingness to increase the amount of dollars spent for road repair from our taxes? What is it?
I think it's basically probably a little of both.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're in this era of social media where anybody can say anything about anything and assume it's true. And we suffer from that. I think we also suffer from the misimpression that if you bond for roads, that's debt for roads, and you shouldn't do debt for maintenance. Well, in our case, we were talking about three-year payback, so that's not really long-term debt. So it's just a matter of, I think, you know, we'll continue this pay-as-you-go program, and anytime the voters get sick of it and want to go back into capital debt financing, they can do that through a voter-approved bond issue, but they got to convince elected officials that it's viable.
Now, this mechanism is for maintenance as well as new roads?
This mechanism we're enacting now is only for maintenance.
Only for maintenance.
Only for maintenance. New roads, I don't think we're going to build a new road in the next 10 years or widen an existing road for the next 10 years until we can solve the maintenance problem.
What do you think the future of the RTA is?
I think the RTA has a good future. They've delivered on what they said they're going to do. They need to basically go back out to the voters within the next 2 to 3 years, and I think they have the opportunity to increase the sales tax to 1%. If they can do that, they can make a huge investment in maintenance, as well as then the mobility investments that they need for road widenings and transit improvements.
You know, approval of RTA money was the first time I think the voters in Pima County or in the city ever said yes to transportation dollars like that. I think it was the very first time.
Well, if you remember, I think it was the fifth try.
Yeah, I mean, people said no to it so many times. I mean, it just seemed to be hopeless. But I'll tell you, through the recession of 2007, 2008, and 2009, when you saw all these people working on every street corner in town, right, just about, you said, gee, somebody's doing something here.
And
made a huge difference.
Oh, and the important part is that we got the best pricing we're ever going to
get.
Yeah.
And you would never be able to buy supplies or anything else that low again.
That's correct. And so now we're in a pretty heated economy. Things are going good. There's a shortage of construction workers. Material prices are going up. So we're seeing more expensive investment needed now in roadwear.
Well, the idea, too, is that people just were working during that particular period of time, and it was so encouraging to see that. And you saw it everywhere.
Oh, yeah. People basically understood that.
I don't know where we would have been if we didn't say yes to that RTA proposal. I don't know where it would have been.
That investment helped employ a lot of people.
Yeah, it did, for a long period of time.
Correct.
And it comes back up for renewal when?
Comes back up for renewal, we think, probably in about 2022. So I would anticipate that you'll probably see an election being talked about. Plans are starting to be put together now, but it takes 2 to 3 years to put a consensus plan together. So that's why I say probably election 2022.
Is the county out of the bond business for a while?
I think
you've been told no so many times. Well, it's like getting slapped.
I think we are, and I think, you know, in one respect, it's probably okay if we basically really do pay-as-you-go financing, which means we need to find a revenue source of about $50 to $60 million a year to put into capital improvements. You can't not bond and not do pay as you go, or else your entire infrastructure basically deteriorates, and you find yourself in the same position we're in with our roads today.
All right, let's come back to our original subject, which is, of course, this fabulous Benedictine monastery. What has happened? I got about 2 minutes left here. This is an iconic building. I believe the architect designed the old county building downtown, right?
Yeah, the historic courthouse.
The courthouse.
Yep.
Was it Roy?
Roy Place.
Place. I wasn't aware of that.
Yep.
A lot of people weren't.
Yeah. No, it's, if you look at the architecture of this building, it looks exactly like the historic courthouse.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful building.
Yeah,
and it's going to be preserved. We're going to be talking to the owner of this building coming up next. But it's been an amazing, I think, accomplishment just to get him on board and have him facilitate a lot of all of this that's taken place.
It's been a very generous offer that he's allowed this to be used for this humanitarian purpose, and I think he's done well.
Yeah, he's a real hero to a great many people, because he could have said no. So his building, his money.
That's correct.
And he said yes to it. And I think he'll find a way to make this a part of the community and have the doors open for people to enjoy it as it has been used for so many years for so many purposes.
That's correct. The sanctuary in particular.
Yeah. Chuck Huckleberry, it's very good to see you again. Thank
John,
you so
good
very
to see
much.
You.
And what has happened here has been just a miracle. I think it's a great American story, a great Arizona story, a great Tucson story. It's a story about us, isn't it?
It's what happens when people work together.
It is absolutely that. Thank you for being
with
us. We'll be back to the Benedictine Monastery at 800 North Country Club as we tell the story of the immigrants coming through here and the lives that have been saved and lives that have been affected. That comes up after these messages and a world news report at the top of the hour.